I would like to go quickly over the rest of the things that I was talking about, and for the benefit of those of you who weren't here, I'll just take a couple of minutes recapitulating, and also for the benefit of those of you who were here but have forgotten already. I was talking on the subject of calling the whole church to take the whole gospel to the whole world, and I spent the previous session talking about the whole gospel. We need to be clear in our definition of the gospel, with particular reference to the condition of mankind and the uniqueness of Christ. We need to be careful in our defense of the gospel against false gospels, half gospels, against relativism and against syncretism. And we also need to be clear in our declaration of the gospel. And we talked a little bit about the balance of the proclamation of word, the incarnation of deed, and the necessity for power encounters. That was what I said in that last hour. It shows how quickly I could have got through it if I'd been so inclined, but I didn't, obviously. Well, now let me go rather quickly through these next two things, and recognizing that we're talking in terms of the church's mission, but also we're concerned about communication. One of the major aspects of communication is you've got to have a knowledge of what you're communicating, but also you've got to have a working knowledge of the people to whom you are communicating. And as far as those to whom we are communicating is concerned, I think this is of great significance. So let me talk to you about the whole world for a few minutes. When we think in terms of communicating the Christian gospel to the whole world, I think there are two major considerations. The first one is we need to be clear in terms of the world's population, what is really happening in terms of population. I was born in 1930, and there were then 2 billion people on the face of God's earth. Because I lived at the correct speed, I was 40 in 1970. There were then 4 billion people on the face of God's earth. If I continue my relentless progress, I will be 60 in the year 2000, and there will then be in excess of 6 billion people on earth. Now, just break that down into the 2 billions. From the beginning of time to 1930, for 2 billion. 40 years for the next 2 billion, less than 20 years for the next 2 billion. And that would be in my 70 years and 10 if I last that long. Now, I've not done any projections after the year 2000, but it will be in excess of 6 billion. I think that you're the generation that needs to be doing some projections there. But let me assure you that they are challenging in the extreme. So if we're thinking seriously about communicating the whole gospel to the whole world, we have got to be thinking in terms of gearing up our effort. And I think this is something that we have got to get across to our church. Any church that is interested in maintaining the status quo is clearly out of step, in my opinion. That what we need to be thinking in terms of is how are we going to increase the effectiveness of our ministry in communicating the gospel to the 6 billion approximately. I was talking about this to some church leaders, in fact a few hundred church leaders in Johannesburg, South Africa, and I was talking quite glibly about 6 billion, 4 billion, 2 billion, and it suddenly occurred to me that the word billion is used in different ways. For instance, in Britain, a billion is a million million. But in America, a billion is 1,000 million. And so I asked the South Africans, now when we talk about 6 billions, are we talking about 6 million million? Are we talking about 6,000 million? And being a good evangelical gathering, of course, they were totally divided on the subject. In fact, about half and half. About half thought it was 6,000 million, about half thought it was 6 million million. Now, I think you'll agree with me that there is a substantial difference between the two. Now, I know you all know what it is, so I won't bother getting into that. Well, in case you're not sure, it is 6,000 million. Fortunately, but that is still a massive task. Now, we have a rule in our church that the best way to eat an elephant is in bite-sized pieces. And so how do we handle this 6 billion? How do we begin even to communicate to them? Fortunately, we can divide the 6 billion down into three more or less equal segments. There are 2 billion who would be, for want of a better term, Christianized. Now, I use that term carefully, Christianized. One-third of the world's population, no more than the world's population, have given some kind of response to the Christian gospel. Then there are 2 billion unevangelized. They are people who at this present time are reachable with the Christian gospel, but as yet have not responded to it. 2 billion. And then there's a third 2 billion, and they are the unreached. They are the people who, if they would like a presentation of the Christian gospel in their mother tongue or their heart language, today it is not available to them. 2 billion. Now, it's rather obvious when you think in those categories that our strategy for communicating the Christian gospel to them has got to vary dramatically. How do we communicate the Christian gospel to the Christianized 2 billion? Or perhaps more importantly, do we need to? How do we communicate the Christian gospel to those who are reachable at this present time but have not as yet responded? And what in the world are we going to do about the 2 billion who at this point are not really in touch with the Christian gospel? What can be done there? Clearly different strategies are necessary in terms of our communication. Let me just talk to you for a few minutes about the Christianized 2 billion. One of the most disconcerting aspects of the Christianized 2 billion is that it is estimated that 3/4 of them are nominal Christians. So it's bad enough that we only number 2 billion Christianized, but it's even worse when we realize that the estimates are that 3/4 of those 2 billion are nominal Christians. Now, my personal feeling is that we therefore need to be particularly concerned about how do we communicate the Christian gospel to nominal Christians? Because most of the Christians in Australia will spend the whole of their lives the mission field that they will spend most of their time on will be a mission field to nominal Christians. Most of them will never be on an unevangelized field. Most of them, for obvious reasons, will never be on an unreached field. And my personal conviction is that one of the great needs in our churches, in Australia, in the United States, in Europe, is how do we communicate the Christian gospel to nominal Christians? Now, let me define a nominal Christian. A nominal Christian would be, by definition, somebody who calls themselves or is called by others a Christian, but shows little or no evidence of a personal relationship of discipleship to Jesus Christ. Now, I think we all know perfectly well that Australia is full of those kind of people. Well, Australia isn't full of people, is it? But you know what I mean. Of the 16 million people plus in Australia, I would imagine that a high percentage of them would probably call themselves Christians. Or, in terms of the demographic maps that show the world religions, most of them would be called Christians, because this is a, quote, Christian country. But if we begin to look at the numbers of Australians who have a personal commitment to Jesus Christ, then I think probably we would have to say there is a vast mission field there. How do we begin to communicate the Christian gospel to them? I met with a group of university students in the University of South Australia in Adelaide just last week. Very early morning breakfast we had together. There were about 40 or 50 of them, and we talked about this business. What is going to be involved in communicating the Christian gospel to the nominal Christian? Some of the things that I suggested to them, and we had good discussion on it, were that I think one of the problems that we've traditionally had in evangelicalism in communicating the gospel to nominal Christians is that we've got off on the wrong foot. For instance, in the city in which I live, there is a strong allegiance to churches. 84% of the population of our city is either Lutheran or Catholic. Now, this is not a diatribe against either Lutheranism or Catholicism. This is a simple statement of fact. 84% of the population of the city of 1.25 million where I minister are Lutherans or Catholics. However, the vast majority of them never go near church. The vast majority of them live lives that would by no stretch of the imagination equate to biblical Christianity. Now, this particular city, I believe because of this orientation, it has been known traditionally as the graveyard of evangelism. In fact, when word was out that I was planning to go there as a pastor, somebody called me and said, "You know that Dwight L. Moody called Milwaukee the graveyard of evangelists, don't you?" And I said, "No, I didn't know that." They said, "Well, it is. You better reconsider." Another international evangelist called me, a personal friend. He died recently. And he said, "Stuart, of all the cities around the world I preached in, Milwaukee," I was there for 2 weeks. He said, "Milwaukee was the worst 2 weeks of my life." He said, it's awful. Cliff Barrows of the Billy Graham team called me and said, "Stuart, you have to realize this, that Milwaukee is the largest city in America to which Billy has never been invited." He said, "It is death on evangelism. It is dead to evangelicalism." Well, being a perverse sort of character, this made me more interested in going, I have to admit. And one of the things I discovered as soon as I got there was why evangelicals were having a hard time in Milwaukee. Because, you see, they went the traditional evangelical line to people and said, "You must be born again." Now, I'm very much in favor of that. I believe Jesus was right when he said that if you're not born again, not only will you not enter the kingdom, you won't even understand it. You won't see it. But the problem with approaching, quote, nominal Christians with the message, "You must be born again," is that in all probability they will respond by saying, "I was born again in my baptism." And so then what do you say? Well, you have your doubts, because the evidence of being born again is that you're living anew. So what are you going to say to somebody who's totally convinced they were born again in their baptism, but give no evidence of living anew? Well, one of the things you can say is, "No, you weren't. You weren't born again in your baptism." And they say, "Yes, I was." And you say, "No, you weren't." And they say, "Who do you think you are to tell me whether I was born again in my baptism or not?" And so what happens is, within the space of 1 minute, your witnessing is degenerated into an argument. Within the space of 5 minutes, it's all over. It's kaput. And this happens over and over and over again. Now, it seems to me that we've got to be able to do better than that. How do we approach the person who is convinced that they were born again in their baptism, but who shows no evidence of spiritual life, assuming that the evidence that you've been born is that you're alive? I'm convinced I was born. Absolutely convinced. You have a very difficult time persuading me otherwise. The reason I'm convinced that I was born is that I remember in minute detail what happened the day I was born. Right? No. The reason I'm convinced I was born is I'm alive. The reason I'm convinced that people are born again is not necessarily that they can give me all the intimate details of a particular action they took at the end of a meeting. The reason I'm convinced they're born again is that they're living in newness of life. So here I've got the problem. The person is absolutely convinced they were born again, shows no evidence of new life. Shows no interest in God's word, shows no interest in prayer, shows no interest in worship, shows no evidence of discipleship, shows no evidence of biblical morality, shows no interest whatsoever in Christian community, shows no interest whatsoever in Christian service. Never form of godliness, no power whatsoever. It seems to me that one of the things that we can do in talking to people like that is say, you know, being born is a mystery when you think about it. There's a lot we understand about it, but there's a mystery. And I often say to people, you know, as I've said, I know I was born because I'm alive, but if you want to pinpoint when I actually started my career, you could say that I started it when I was born. But somebody would immediately say, well, no, there's a sense in which you were an embryo. And other people would say, well, but in actual fact, before you were an embryo, you were a sperm and an egg. And somebody else would say, yeah, but before you were a sperm and an egg, you were a glint in your father's eye. And somebody else would say, but when you come to think about it, there would have been no father, no mother if there hadn't been two sets of grandparents. And when you start going back and back and back and back and back and back and back, it's extremely difficult to figure out when you started. Now, there's no question about it that there was a cataclysmic event called birth. Very, very dramatic indeed. But there's equally no doubt about it that all kinds of things happened before. Now then, if we can draw an analogy here about new birth, there is no question about it that in some people's experiences there is a cataclysmic point of repentance and they do a major U-turn. And they know it and everybody else knows it. And they look at them and they say, he's gone out of his mind. And other people say, praise God, he's being converted. Depends on which side of the fence they're coming from. But let's face it, there are a lot of other people who never go through that cataclysmic U-turn and yet show evidence of newness of life. There are two aspects to regeneration. The first aspect is the grace of God in intervening in people's experience. The other is the faith of man in response to divine grace. Paul summarizes it, as we well know, in Ephesians 2:8-9, for by grace are you saved through faith, not of works, etc., etc. My approach to the people in nominal Christianity, or one of the approaches, is simply this. I say, you know, I am so glad that you had parents, for whatever their reasons, felt it was necessary to have you baptized when you were a child. I'm really glad. And I think there could well be some major significance in that. It could well be that that was all part of that mysterious work of grace, that embryonic work of grace that was going on, without which you would never have come to faith. For let's face it, there is no way that you're going to come to faith unless there is some work of grace. No one can come to the Father except the Father draw him. Now, who's to know the ways in which the Father begins to work? Isn't it wonderfully possible that in those mysterious events that were taking place long before you were conscious, both physically and spiritually, that God was graciously at work? This does not suggest for a minute that there is not a time when you're born. It does not suggest for a minute there isn't a time when you're born again. There's no question about it that you stopped being an embryo and you became an independent person. By the same token, there's no question about it that there is embryonic work of God, grace of God, prevenient work of God going on. There's equally no question about it that somewhere along the line that work of grace has to be mixed with faith. Now, I found that simply talking to people on this level, you avoid an adversarial position. You begin to highlight something that is sometimes underemphasized in evangelical witnessing. Because you see, in our concern to highlight human faith, there's sometimes a tendency to underemphasize divine grace. in our concern to emphasize the necessity for people to respond, there's sometimes a tendency for us to underestimate the work of God that has already given us something to respond to. My approach has simply been, in this regard, to take out of the situation that which is going to bring an unnecessary confrontation. Now, some people don't like this approach. Some people say that I'm, quote, watering it down, although I count the life, let me see where I am. Because what I'm endeavoring to do is to show that there is the work of grace and there is the response of faith. For obvious reasons, Baptists are suspicious of it, but there's nothing in what I'm saying that would not equate to the two fundamentals of regeneration, the divine grace and the human faith. I simply give you that as an illustration of how we have been endeavoring to communicate the Christian gospel to the nominal Christian. Let me give you another example on this. I have found that in communicating with the nominal Christian, that there is great legitimacy in accepting their evaluation of themselves at face value. If you don't, then it can be very insulting to them. So if somebody insists to me that they are a Christian, for whatever reason they might believe that they're a Christian, I say, that's wonderful. That's why I'm thrilled to hear that. And then I get into this sort of a conversation with them. I say, have you any idea how often the word Christian appears in the Bible? And more often than not, they say, no, I have no idea. I say, well, it's really a surprise, actually. It only occurs three times. And in actual fact, the first time it occurs, it was a nickname given by some people who lived in Antioch of Syria to those who were the followers of what up until that time was called followers of the way. The people in Antioch were well known for giving derogatory nicknames to people. And this was one of them. The Christianoi, they called them, the followers of Christ. And those followers of the way, they simply said, hey, you know, that's a nice name, we'll keep it. And so that was how the name stuck. Now, Agrippa, of course, talking to Paul, he said, you've almost persuaded me to be a Christian, and we don't know the tone of voice he said that in. And Peter said, if anybody suffers as a Christian, no sweat. Well, that's an Australian interpretation of what Peter said, but more or less that situation. That's it. Those are the only mentions of Christian. Then I say to the people, you know, there's something very intriguing to me, and it is this, that before people were ever called Christians, in the early days they were called disciples. And in actual fact, the very first people who were called Christians in the same sentence are called disciples. The disciples were called Christians first in Antioch. So I say, would you call yourself a disciple of Jesus Christ? And do you know what the usual answer is? Oh, I wouldn't go that far. You see, because the thinking in the nominal Christian's mind, and incidentally in a lot of, quote, born-again Christians, is that there's sort of a level of Christianity that if you want to go in for the super added extra plus style, you become a disciple. When in actual fact, there's no dichotomy in Scripture. The mandate of the Lord Jesus was very, very straightforward. He said, you go and disciple the nations. You make disciples of all nations. Now, at this point, I've accepted their evaluation of themselves. They call themselves a Christian. I said, great, let's find out more about what it means to be a Christian. What it means to be a Christian certainly has to do with being a disciple. Then I point out something else to them. In the early days, before they had the word Christian, they were known as disciples. But then later on, they didn't use the word disciple much at all. And they didn't use the word Christian much at all either. Do you know what they called themselves? They called themselves saints. Now, would you call yourself a saint? And they said, no. Well, I said, you are one if you're a Christian. What, me? A saint? Yeah. Now, your wife may not realize it, but yes, you're a saint. Now, immediately, you see, you're not getting into any argument with them. You're not getting into any confrontation with them. You're simply taking them where they are, and you're moving them on to where they want to go. That's another approach of communicating the gospel to the nominal Christian. Here's another problem. You'll find very, very often that the nominal Christian has got some rather warm thoughts about Christ, but has got some very negative thoughts about the church. Got some warm thoughts about Christ, got some negative thoughts about the church. Now, how do you do that? What do you do there? One of the traps that you can fall into is to vehemently defend the church. Well, one of the worst things you can do is defend the indefensible. One of the worst things you can do is start saying a whole lot of things about the church that just aren't true. In fact, the best way of communicating with people is to find points of agreement with them. And when they start finding fault with the church, you say to them, "Oh, hey, listen, you're right. I said, you're on the outside looking in. Let me tell you what it's like to be on the inside." And give them some more points. And then begin to point out to them what the church is, and what the church is intended to be, and what the church is working towards. And I believe that if we can begin to start from that point, and begin to show people what the church is intended to be, and how far it has got away from what it's intended to be, they will begin to discover something of very real significance there. The mean age of the adults in our church back home is 34, which means that they are what is known in America as the baby boomers. Has that term got over here? They are the most analyzed and criticized and evaluated group in history. I mean, baby boomers, everybody has poked and prodded them and surveyed them and analyzed them, and we know everything there is to know, everything you could want to know, and a vast amount that we don't need to know about the baby boomers. My two senior associates on the staff back home are, one of them is 35 and the other one is 40 years of age. So they're very much in that generation. I'm the old man. And these are the two guys with whom I work very closely on my staff at home. And we were talking the other day, and one of them said to me, "Stuart, your generation has majored on conviction and commitment. Conviction and commitment." And he said, one of the reasons that the baby boomers have the kind of world that they can enjoy in many ways is that the world that they enjoy is the direct product of your generation, because they were committed and they had convictions. Now, he said, you have to understand that our generation, rightly or wrongly, is not particularly concerned about commitment or conviction. What we're interested in is compassion and community. Now, this is a very interesting insight. Now, he went on to say this. It's very helpful to have young men who've got their PhDs working on your staff with you. He then went on to say this. The Church of Jesus Christ is in deep trouble if it backs away from commitment and conviction. But unless the church can begin to incorporate into what young people see as a sort of hard-nosed conviction and commitment, unless they can begin to incorporate a generous sense of community and compassion, they may as well whistle up a drain pipe, because they're not going to get anywhere. Now, the thing that we have discovered in working with the, quote, nominal Christian and their objections to the church is to begin to show them that the church, in actual fact, is intended to produce a sense of community that manifests compassion. And they go for it like a salmon will go for a fly. So here's another way of communicating the Christian gospel to the nominal Christian. Now, those are some of the ways in which we've been doing it. I'd like to pause here because, you know, you may have some things that you want to contribute to this, or you may have some questions. You may have want some clarification. Is there anything of that nature that you want to contribute at this point? If you wouldn't mind using the mic, because this is going to give you the opportunity of broadcasting coast to coast.
The only comment I was going to make is that in agreement with your statement about not being ashamed to admit the way the church has fallen short. I've found many times in talking with non-Christians and having serious conversations, the fact that they criticise the church, and if I am willing to admit to them that the church has done a lot of evil things and a lot of bad things have been done in the name of God, it rocks them back on their feet, and all of a sudden it just changes the whole course of their conversation because they realise I'm not trying to defend the indefensible, as you said.
Right.
Do you guide the nominal Christians into the church or into home fellowships that have a feeling against the church?
We would guide them into whatever entry level opportunity we feel is going to be appropriate to them. And let me clarify what I mean by entry level. I think that one of the very important things that we have to do in our communication of the gospel to people is to recognize that sometimes the level that we want them to enter into spiritual life is far too advanced for them. We want them to come into a church service where the music has come from a different era, where people talk a language they've never heard, where they have to dress in ways they've never dressed, all kinds of hindrances there. Or where we may be talking about things that they're not remotely interested in. And therefore, I believe that it is incumbent on the church to have all kinds of relatively easy contact points or entry-level opportunities for people. So it would depend who they are. If you make a contact with somebody who lives in a neighborhood where they've already got some contacts with people who meet in a small group, and they're willing to go to that, but yes, by all means. Some people, of course, if they're very nominal, much prefer the anonymity of a large group, and they would feel very threatened with a small group. Other people are overwhelmed by a larger group, and they feel much more comfortable in a small group. You just have to be sensitive to what they respond to. We have found also that a lot of our most effective small group work is based on a common interest. In other words, We have found that you can get some people into a small group for the very simple reason that they're young mothers. And to tell them we have a group of young mothers who meet on a Wednesday morning, and that we have nursery care for their children, and that there will be talks that will help them in their young mothering, that immediately introduces them into the interest group where they are. We've found that some other people will go only to peer groups. And by that I mean, for instance, single people. Most single people don't particularly want to go into a group with just married people. There are some exceptions to this, but usually they prefer to be with singles. Their objection is, if you get with married people, all they talk about is their kids. And we feel like we don't belong. And so we have started all kinds of single groups for them. Now, having said that, single covers everything. It can cover a young student who's just graduated from university, is embarking on a career, and is celebrating because they've got their first pay packet, and they're just having a whale of a time. Or it can go all the way to a 75-year-old widow who's just lost her husband of 50 years, and she's desolate. But they're both single. So we have entry levels for all of them. And so, this is a very long answer to your question, but the succinct answer to the question is we would try to integrate them into whatever entry point opportunity seems to fit that particular person.
Something I've noticed in Australia a lot is people want to see Christianity more lived out than sort of preached at them, sort of thing. People want to see it lived out. Do you think that's a trend in the Western Christianized world, where people want to see Christianity more lived out than preached out, sort of thing?
Yes, I do. And I think that has to do with those two words that I mentioned that the baby boomers are looking for, community and compassion. That's another way of saying, let's see your Christianity lived out. Let's see you expressing compassionate concern for people, and let's see you building relationships. And, of course, the church has a commitment to these things. So I bring out my old word, commitment, and we have convictions about these things as well. So it's not either or. And what we're trying to do in our church is we've thought these things through. We're trying to say, let's make sure that we have some real convictions and some real commitments to be in a compassionate community. Which, in, to use your terminology, is yes. Let's see if there aren't some ways in which we can show that what we believe works. Absolutely.
Have you seen this type of approach? You're talking about in evangelising, or this type of evangelism. Have you seen, you talked about the great percentage of Catholics and Lutherans that just wouldn't ever go to a church. Have you found that they are tending to come to these type of things, like where you're really reaching out to them and showing them the compassion and that type of thing? That you're seeing a breakthrough there?
Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Literally hundreds of people. And we work with them in different ways. Some of them come alive in Christ. Their Lutheran tradition is very important to them, and so we encourage them to get back into the Lutheran churches and take this newness of life there. And of course, there are many of the churches are very much alive, and so we steer them in the direction of those. And the same is true in some Catholic churches. Well, obviously, there are areas of where we'd not go along with Catholic dogma, but there are some people who, for a variety of reasons, feel that they want to stay there. We continue to minister to them and encourage them, and we're seeing some very, very interesting things happen in many of their churches as well. But the vast majority of them, because they've already severed everything but nominal links with the old church, they've severed the emotional links. They didn't really have any significant spiritual links. They have become integrated into the fellowship that we are part of. Okay, have we done nominalism all right then? All right, let me just touch on very quickly then on the other two areas where we're going to be thinking in terms of communicating the Christian gospel, and that is communicating to the unevangelized. Now, we're talking about two billion people who have minimal exposure to the Christian gospel, but are reachable. What we have to do in this regard is recognize something really quite significant, and that is that there are vast numbers of people who are reachable, but we are lacking the manpower and the resources to do it. And that therefore, if we're going to think realistically about mobilizing the church to reach those kind of people, in terms of generating much more interest, and particularly in the Western Church, where there is a declining interest in getting into cross-cultural communication of the Christian gospel. Let me give you one or two little ideas about the sort of things that can happen. When Billy Graham preached in London recently, well it's a year or so ago now, there was a link up with some of the African nations, and Bishop Augustus Marway was telling us that in Liberia, this was before the terrible civil war that they had, in Liberia, Liberian television preempted all other broadcasting and simply broadcast live Billy Graham from London. And so in actual fact, every television set in the whole of the nation that was turned on in those nights was listening to a presentation of the Christian gospel. that's an incredible outreach. Another thing that's interesting in this area, for instance, is that the Jesus film has been translated into 130 languages and is viewed by 500,000 people every single day. So we're talking about vast numbers, but we're talking about ways in which it is possible to communicate the Christian gospel. In the Soviet Union, there are tremendous opportunities. One Soviet evangelist told us, and this was he told us this before Perestroika and Glasnost really got rolling, and obviously before things started coming unstuck as they are now. But he said that he could go into cities in the Soviet Republic where he lived any city he wanted to, he could go into the marketplace and he could open a Christian bookstore and he could sell Christian books if he could get them. He would cut the books down into chapters and sell a chapter a piece, and people would keep track of where the other chapters were. If he got magazines, he would tear pages and he'd sell them a page of the magazine. They'd keep track of where the others were. He could go from door to door and talk to people about Jesus Christ, and he could rent the local sports hall, and he said it would be packed out every night, and they'd go until midnight talking about Jesus. And so this is the sort of thing that was happening in the Soviet Union. And the simple fact of the matter is this, that all over the world there are literally hundreds of thousands of people who are reachable at the present time, but we need the manpower and we need the means to do it. And so this has to be a concern if we're going to call the whole church, take the whole gospel to the whole world. And then, of course, as far as the unreached are concerned, the 2 billion have never heard the gospel of Christ. One of the very interesting things that happened between Lausanne 1 in 1974 and Lausanne 2 in 1989 was that in 1974 they were talking all the time about closed countries. And in 1989 they didn't mention closed countries, they talked about limited access countries. Because they have come around to some very simple conclusions, and that is that there is no such thing as a closed country. In the broadest sense of the word, there's no such thing as a country that is closed to prayer. If we get our act together, there will soon be no such thing as a country closed to radio, Christian radio. We are seeing more and more that closed countries are becoming increasingly interested in ties, granted economic ties, to the Christianized West. Which means that there's no such thing now as a closed door to Christian businessmen and skilled tent makers going in and out. There's no such thing nowadays as closed doors to sports. The Christian church has known for years that music is an international language. We're finally catching on that there's a second international language, and that is sport. And that there are vast opportunities for going into all kinds of closed situations. And so, as far as the unreached are concerned, we've got to be saying to ourselves, what are the strategies that we're going to be using in order that we might communicate the gospel to the unevangelized and the unreached? Now, having said all that, as far as the whole world is concerned, there are some basic problems. And let me just identify them for you. One is the problem of urbanization. There are, as you know, vast movements towards the major cities. This is something that's very obvious in Australia. You're 16 million people. I think 7 million of them are found in Melbourne and Sydney. Am I right? And then in Brisbane and in Adelaide and in Perth, you've got close to another 3 million. So you've got about 10 million of your 16 million in the capital cities. And this is urbanization. Now here it's been handled reasonably well. Very well indeed. I think your cities are beautiful. Particularly Brisbane and Perth, incidentally, are my two favourites. But urbanization in other parts of the world is a desperate problem. And when you go into many of the great, what they're now calling world-class cities, you're seeing cities that have a bigger population than vast countries. I'm not quite sure. Does anybody know what the population of Mexico City is now? I would imagine it's a bit. Pardon? Well, I was going to say it's going to be close to the population of Australia. I was in São Paulo, Brazil, with a Canadian missionary, and he was telling me about the vast size of Canada, which I know about because I've gone from coast to coast in Canada, and he was equating the population of Canada to the population of São Paulo, Brazil. And the problem with urbanization, of course, is that the infrastructure of those cities is incapable of handling the influx of people. And is collapsing. But as far as we're concerned in communicating the Christian gospel, one of the things we have to recognize is this, that traditionally, evangelicalism has done much better in rural areas than urban areas. And that we are therefore confronting immense problems. Because this vast growing population is not in the Christianized West, It is in the third world countries, for want of a better term, and it is in the major urban areas. And so the concern that we have to have is, how are we going to gear up to communicate the Christian gospel in the burgeoning urban areas of the third world? That's a problem. Increasing secularization is another problem. More and more indifference to religion. Modernization. Just let me throw out one or two things here, because I think that they're very material. I won't go into details with them. Modernization means that there are some basic switches in people's thought processes. And they are a switch from word to image, a switch from action to spectacle, a switch from truth to feeling, and a switch from conviction to sentiment. Now just quick comment on each one of those, just to try to show you how significant these things are in terms of communicating the Christian gospel. The switch from word to image. You know the old cliche, a picture is worth a thousand words. Nobody ever tells you which words, though. So you look at a picture and they say, that is worth a thousand words, but it is a purely subjective experience. You can interpret that picture exactly how you wish. That is why the move to images as opposed to words is of profound significance to those interested in communicating the Christian gospel. Because when you communicate the Christian gospel, you have to be precise. We are dealing with propositional truth. We're dealing with things that are right and we're dealing with things that are wrong. We cannot afford simply to put up an image and allow people to come to their own conclusions. And yet more and more we're discovering that people are image orientated rather than word orientated. Or to put it in simple terms, they'd rather watch TV than read a book. Now, that being the case, that is going to pose increasing problems for the precise communication of the Christian gospel. Now, we don't have time to go into detail there. The switch from action to spectacle, that obviously has problems for the communication of the gospel. The switch from truth to feeling. It used to be not too long ago that when you were having a discussion with somebody, you'd make a statement and then you'd ask them, what do you think about that? Now the question usually is, how do you feel about that? Now that may be a very subtle difference, but in actual fact it's a monumental difference in this regard. That when you thought in terms of thinking about truth as opposed to feeling about things, the thing that determined the validity of a thing used to be whether it was true or not. The thing that determines the validity now is how you react to it. And so the idea now is, if it feels okay, it must be right. When in actual fact, we all know that it is possible to feel very comfortable with something that's wrong. Therefore, if people are more interested in evaluating things, not on the basis of whether it is true, but how it feels, then we've got major problems in communicating the Christian gospel to them. And we need to address this. And then, of course, conviction as opposed to sentiment. I don't think there's any question about it that it is impossible to see the images of the Kurdish refugees on television and not be moved. But I think it would also be very true to say that it is possible to be moved by those images and continue to eat your supper and do nothing about it. Now, there could be various reasons for that, but one of the reasons is that our society is open to sentiment, but is not necessarily open to conviction. And so this poses problems for us in the communication of the Christian gospel. So the modernization is really a problem in terms of communication. Persecution is going to be another problem. Persecution. Just a couple of statistics here. I know that they can be an awful bore. but I've got them, so I may as well bore you with them. Since the beginning of the Christian era, there have been in excess of 40 million martyrs, Christian martyrs. However, a quarter of them have been martyred since 1950. A quarter of them in the last 40 years. The general perception is, in the bad old days, they used to martyr people. In actual fact, the reverse is true. There are more people being martyred for their faith now than ever in Christian history. And the projections are horrendous. I won't go into those numbers, but they have to be confronted. Now then, granted we've got a whole gospel, and granted we've got a whole world to go at, the question now is, how do we mobilize the whole church to do something about it?